This panel discussion at the 10th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference, put on by the Migration Policy Institute and other organizations, focuses on life beyond congressional action. The panel is moderated by Jean Atkinson, Executive Director of the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, Inc., which is an organizer of the 10th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference. The speakers include Mary Elena Hincapie, who is Executive Director of the National Immigration Law Center, Lyndon Melmed, who is a partner with Barry Appleman in Leiden and is former Chief Counsel to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, as well as former Special Counsel to Senator John Cornyn of Texas, and Wendy Young, President of Kids in Need of Defense. Here's Jean Atkinson.
My name is Jean Atkinson, and I'm really happy to be here with you all today. As we heard in the first panel, the prospects for immigration reform are unclear. If Congress fails to act, the consequences will continue to be felt in communities around the nation. And as Lorella very eloquently stated this morning, we're talking about human beings here. Young people granted deferred action will be in limbo. Employers, as Governor Barbour mentioned this morning, will have trouble fulfilling their hiring needs. Families will remain separated, and communities will be fractured as they continue to put harmful state and local ordinances. We have a very experienced and knowledgeable panel this morning, and we are going to address the question, or they are going to address the question of, if Congress fails to act, what can and might happen? So I encourage you to look at their bios in the program. I'm not going to take time now because I'd rather we save time for questions. But they will address a variety of issues. I'll introduce them one at a time. We're going to start off with Wendy Young. Wendy is president and executive director of Kids in Need of Defense. KIND is the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. So, Wendy, drawing on your extensive policy experience, can you tell us who are the vulnerable migrants that we're talking about and with whom you've worked for many years, and what options might be available for them?
Sure. Thank you. And good morning, everyone. And first, I think the prior panel was channeling my father, who I grew up under the phrase, life is always darkest before it's completely and utterly black. He was a true pessimist. So hopefully our panel will shed a little bit more light on things. Or not more light, but turn the lights back on. And also I'd like to say that, you know, the title of the session is Life Beyond Congressional Action. In many ways, what I'm going to talk about is life before, during, and after congressional action. Because some of the suggestions and recommendations I'm going to make can be done absent comprehensive immigration reform. You know, I think everybody's in agreement, regardless of what your perspective is on immigration, that the system is broken and dysfunctional, and that an overhaul and reform legislation is needed. KIND, which, as Jean said, works with unaccompanied immigrant children who arrive alone in the United States, of whom last year there were 23,500. Also is in agreement that we need legislation, and we've been very actively pushing that that legislation include provisions to increase protections for unaccompanied children. But even as I look at the provisions that we advocated for in the legislation and continue to advocate for, even on those issues, a lot can be done absent legislation through administrative action. So let me start with a few of them. One is a fairly, I would say, revolutionary concept in the immigration system, which is the appointment of legal counsel to individuals who are in deportation or removal proceedings. The comprehensive immigration reform mandates that the Attorney General has the authority to appoint counsel to individuals who are either unaccompanied children or lack the competency to face those proceedings alone. But I'm really of the opinion we don't need legislation to do that, despite Section 292 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which basically states that individuals have the privilege of counsel, but at no expense to the government. That provision could be interpreted that the government's not required to appoint counsel, but could do so at its discretion. And in fact, we're starting to see some progress on that front, partly in response to the Franco litigation. The Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security have agreed to screen individuals for competency to see if they really, because of mental disorders, can't face immigration proceedings without counsel, and to permit the appointment of counsel for individuals who are deemed to be mentally incompetent. The next logical extension of that program really should be to unaccompanied children who equally lack the competency to face immigration proceedings alone. I frequently share a story that of something I saw in immigration court in Baltimore about a year and a half ago that has just stuck with me, even though I've been working on this issue since 1989. I was in court just watching the juvenile docket one day, and a five-year-old girl walked in with no lawyer. And she was dressed in her Sunday best. She had her little Ugg boots on, ponytails, and she was clutching a doll. And when she sat behind the respondent's table, she could not see over the edge of that table. And the immigration judge had to proceed to question this child about her circumstances in the United States, conceivably to make a decision on her behalf about literally her future and her fate. We managed to find that child a pro bono attorney with one of our partner law firms, and I asked my staff later, what was it like to work with a five-year-old under these circumstances? And she said, honestly, it took a lot of Play-Doh and a lot of candy, but it also took a lawyer. And putting young children through proceedings unrepresented, putting individuals who have competency issues through proceedings unrepresented, does not reflect well on the values of this country. Second thing that I think can be done administratively, there's legislation already out there that's been enacted that we've been waiting years for regulations on. Asylum is probably the best example. Regulations were proposed at the end of the Clinton administration 13 years ago, and we're still waiting on that regulation to be finalized. It's a critical regulation because it would really encapsulate the United States interpretation of membership in a particular social group under the refugee definition, which is the category under which a lot of vulnerable individuals raise an asylum claim, particularly women fleeing gender persecution, individuals with sexual orientation claims, and unaccompanied children. That regulation should move forward quickly. The Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, which passed in 2008, regulations were proposed in 2011. We're still waiting for those regulations. The administration should move much more quickly to get those regs out there so that we really can clarify where the United States stands on some very important issues that are already in our laws. A very obvious one is the increased use of prosecutorial discretion. The PD was rolled out, if I'm remembering right, 2011, time flies when you're having fun, with great fanfare from the administration. But since the announcement that prosecutorial discretion could be exercised in immigration proceedings, only 25,000 individuals have benefited from that program. The administration should put its weight behind it and make it much, much more robust. It's not perfect for people. It's not a true legal status in the United States, but at least it's a down payment as we wait for the legislation to move forward. And it clarifies what the enforcement priorities are. More recently, an announcement was made that actions would be taken to try to prevent family separation. I think you've all heard the very tragic and heart-wrenching stories of families being torn apart by deportation. The memo basically says that considerations of family unity should be taken into account both during the detention process as well as during the removal process. Again, this is a memo. It's great. It's a great down payment. Let's make sure that it's implemented fully. Also, there's a lot in law already that's not being fully implemented, and I think there's a lot of procedural reforms that could be undertaken to basically make the immigration process more fair. Turning particularly to unaccompanied children, something that we've been pushing for and unfortunately seem to be losing ground on right now, is the implementation of juvenile dockets in the immigration courts so that there's a day in court in which children are there, they're the focus, the environment can be a little less formal, more relaxed, more child-focused, more child-friendly. The immigration judges, you're not having adult detainees in the back of the courtroom. Unfortunately, because of the number of children increasing so dramatically, we're starting to see slippage, and courts are now, again, docketing kids on the regular adult dockets. It's simple. It's procedural. I would also say border screening of children at in terms of identifying children who are particularly vulnerable and have protection concerns. The TVPRA classified three categories of children who CBP should identify and allow into the country. These include kids who have a credible fear of return, kids where there's a risk of trafficking, and kids who lack the capacity to turn around. This is particularly important for Mexican children who still in most border patrol stations are typically turned around. Less emphasis on detention and more emphasis on alternatives to detention for vulnerable populations in particular. As the number of children have grown who are arriving in the United States, we're seeing the Office of Refugee Resettlement open more children's shelters. Why not think about foster care for these kids? It's a much more appropriate setting for many, many children. And then finally, a favorite project of kind. We're implementing a pilot project, which is one of the first of its kind in Guatemala, for the return and reintegration of children who either agree to voluntary departure or are ordered removed from the country. Historically, kids are returned to their home countries and then pretty much left at the home at the airport under the assumption that the home country child welfare system should be responsible for the care of that child at that point. The reality is most kids are returning to countries who have little or no child welfare systems in place. So we've implemented a project so that a local NGO partner is at the airport with a family member to welcome the child back, helps them back to their home community, and then provides whatever services are necessary to ensure that that child's really safely reintegrated into the home community. That could be family reunification support, re-enrollment in school, job skills training for the older youth, whatever it takes really to allow that child to have a true opportunity to remain home. Because what we see is if they don't receive those types of services, what do? They re-migrate immediately. And for children, this is an incredibly dangerous journey on the way to the United States. These types of programs could be implemented now. And we're talking to the USAID and State Department and others about what we can do to implement these projects more fully and strategically. Training. It's always a favorite subject in the immigrant advocacy community, the lack of training among immigration judges, among CIS officers, among ICE attorneys. And there I'm going to stop and I'm going to end on this note. A lot of what I'm talking about actually also requires something else, which is legislative, which is resources and appropriations. And as we look at comprehensive immigration reform, I hope that we will equally pay attention to resourcing the system so that it can move forward and do some of these things that extend due process and fundamental fairness to individuals who are in the system already. At the end of the day, as we're all, I think, seeking broad, sweeping policy reforms through CIR, again, we have to remember that justice and due process has to be delivered on a case-by-case basis, individual by individual. There are people in the system now who desperately need our help, and I would ask you to remember that 5-year-old in court. She needs a lawyer now. She doesn't need a lawyer next year. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. We will hold questions for the end, but please make note of them. This is a perfect segue to Lyndon Melman. Lyndon is a partner at Barry Appleman & Leiden, LLP. He also has had a long and distinguished career with the U.S. government at USCIS, INS, as well as working in Congress. So, Lyndon, the issue of executive authority has not been without some controversy. What policy areas lend themselves to possible administrative action?
Well, thanks, Jean, and good morning, everyone. Just want to recognize CMS, MPI, and Clinic for their support of the program. I, too, had hoped that this panel would be irrelevant and we would be talking about implementation issues, and maybe that is a very good topic. That's not a slight against our moderator. But I also understand that we have to hope for the best, but plan for the not best, and that's what we are spending a lot of time talking about today in this discussion. I'm going to share a few thoughts about the legal and policy issues that the agency is likely to encounter as they explore some of the legislative proposals. I had the, misfortune of seeing the legislation fail slowly in 2006 when they failed to reach a conference committee between the Senate and the House, and then face a faster demise in 2007 when it failed on two votes. Looking back at 2007 and how the agencies responded, it's really a remarkable timeline. It was a bit of a blur at the time, but it failed on June 28th. And Secretary Chertoff announced 6 weeks later his list of 26 administrative initiatives, as he said, to sharpen the tools for administrative action. And, you know, when you look at that list, it was weighted a little bit more towards enforcement, increased Border Patrol agents, fencing, increased penalties for worksite violations. But there were also tweaks to the visa worker programs, H-2A, H-2B, H-2B, and H-1B. I think the defining character of those proposals, though, and having been there, and I know probably some of you in the room were involved in this, is they were bottom-up proposals. You know, the missive went out to put forward ideas from within the agency of what could be done. And so they came up from within the agency. And so they were all relatively safe, very well vetted, very legal ideas that came up with a lot of agency review. And I think the defining character is they were all relatively small. When we look ahead now at what this administration is contemplating, they've already done deferred action for childhood arrivals. They've already tweaked the provisional waiver program. And so I anticipate that things will be different, irrespective of what happens on the congressional action, and that they'll be looking to build upon those larger programs. So let's start a little bit, start first with the provisional waiver program. As many of you know, folks who can otherwise immigrate through legal channels are barred by the 3 and 10 year bar. And the agency tweaked the process to allow individuals to know before they leave the United States, thereby triggering the bar, whether they would be eligible for the program. I think it's fair to say that the agency didn't really know how many people this would reach. If you look at the analysis of the regulation, they don't know exactly how big this program would be. But the real challenge for the agency with this program up to this point has been operational. The waiver process over the past 10, 20 years has been very decentralized. It's been done remotely. It's been done overseas on case-by-case basis. The agency has done a lot of work over the past year to revise that process and centralize where they're filed and centralize how they're handled. And so though that program has not reached many people to date, that has been in large part just because of a volume issue and operational issue for the agency. They will, I'm certain, be looking to expand that program. Right now it's limited to whether there is harm to, whether the qualifying relationship, excuse me, is with U.S. citizens. It would be easy for them to expand that to the qualifying relationship for permanent residents, thereby expanding who is eligible. But there is one challenge the agency is going to have to deal with, and that's the extreme hardship standard. When you look at the approval rates for the program to date, it's anywhere from 25 to 50%. It's a very high standard. It's not defined in statutes. It's defined through various case decisions and administrative decisions. And as Congress said, extreme hardships, really high standard. Now, my personal experience at the agency was that watching people apply that standard was not your normal continuum of favoring immigrants versus not favoring immigrants. It was really based more upon people's personal life experiences. Do they have children? Have they had medical issues? Do they care for family members? Whenever we would review particular cases and say, is this person eligible or not eligible for it, I was always struck by how much individual adjudicators and senior leaders' decisions on that case was based upon their own personal experience. So if the agency is going to expand the provisional waiver program, reach more people, they're going to have to tackle how to change that standard and how to implement it in an agency where if you put 10 reasonable people in a room, they're all going to have different ideas about what extreme hardship is. So turning to the other program that exists today and I contemplate would be considered for expansion is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Already that's a program that can reach up to 1.4 million individuals, according to some estimates. I think the latest statistics are about 600,000 beneficiaries have come forward under the program. Let me say at the outset, when I talk about DACA, that's sort of the shorthand for it, I think you could also throw in there deferred and forced departure and extended voluntary departure. all three of those are really administrative creatures. They're not in the statute, but they are all vehicles through which the executive branch has foregone removal process and allowed people to stay in the United States and grant them work authorization. As Gene mentioned, these are controversial programs, but just because they're controversial doesn't mean they are new programs. According to one CRS report, they've been used 20 times, I think, in the last 40 years. And by my rough math, which isn't great, at least 2 million individuals have received some sort of benefit through those grants over the past 40 years. So again, controversial, but far from being new. So what will the agency be wrestling with, and what are the big issues as they look to expand and build upon the existing deferred action program? Well, one, we know that there was already one significant legal challenge down in Texas by the ICE unions. Now that core attack against the deferred action prosecutorial discretion program was really based upon an argument that the statute mandates that immigration officers, if someone's not clearly eligible for admission, that the immigration officer detain them and initiate removal proceedings. Now, that's an interesting issue of statutory construction that folks will disagree about. But from where I sit, there's two core reasons why I don't think that's going to be a significant issue for the agency going forward. One was the question of standing, which of course is the reason that the district court in Texas dismissed the case outright, is that it's very difficult for anyone to say they've been harmed by the agency's failure to require their officers to take that action. But even if we assume for argument's sake that there was that mandate and a court required that action, all the court would be requiring is that officers issue NTAs. And so I do think that's something that would create operational problems, but it's not something that the government couldn't work around. So if that's not the significant issue, let's look at what two challenges that the agency's already probably dealt with, but certainly going to have to face if they look to expand the program. The first is that I think there's always an assumption that a program like that is going to be challenged by conservatives or restrictionist groups who want to see it narrowed. But in my experience, I anticipate that the challenge is going to come from folks who are denied benefits under the program. Anytime you set up a program, an immigration benefits program, and decide who gets it and who doesn't get it, they're going to be winners and losers. And the losers, of course, can have standing to challenge it, and they are in a place to say you applied it incorrectly. When you look at the case law for prosecutorial discretion, and the platform in which this stands upon, the courts all say, well, you have discretion, but discretion is not a subterfuge for using it in an arbitrary fashion. So the real question will be, as they expand DACA and someone is denied a benefit under that program, will they challenge the basis for it? Simple hypothetical under the current standards is a 32-year-old who is denied eligibility. Is that someone who's a higher enforcement priority than someone who's 30 years old? And that has not been tested before the courts. It's a tricky issue for the agencies to wrestle with and how to implement this program. And what I've seen is agencies go one of two directions. One, they take a very loosey-goosey approach and have very informal standards. And the approach there is to say, these are general guidelines. Not every case is handled exactly the same. They fall under the case-by-case adjudication. And if you look at the DACA guidance up to this point, it's sprinkled heavily with case-by-case decisions, and that's how it's been applied. The other approach is that you heavily regulate the program. You do a lot of rulemaking, and you try and get as much deference as possible so that when there is a challenge to your policymaking, the courts are going to be more deferential to how you applied that. I think up to this point, you've seen DACA fall into the former category. That was probably driven as much by timing considerations of getting the program off the ground versus legal considerations. But that's something that I think the agency is going to have to think about as they go forward. And I guess I should say there's a third way of defending yourself in a program like that, and that's to not deny any applications or to deny them very sparingly. And when you look at the statistics for DACA up to this point, less than 1% have been denied. Those that are being are denied are typically not because you're 32 years old versus 29 years old, but it's based on criminal grounds or other issues that are easier to defend. And so in the absence of the first or second option, it does drive the agency to take a more liberal approach. The other consideration, and I was really struck by on the earlier panel, Roy Beck's comments about his internal polling of what bothers people about immigration, is the issue of granting work authorization. That's a real touch point for the population that he's talking with. And when you look at the programs like deferred enforced departure, DACA, extended voluntary departure, typically the agency has granted work authorization to those populations. And I can just imagine right here, as he does his polling of his internal group, it's the granting of the work authorization and putting those workers on equal footing in the workplace that is going to be very controversial. Now, for the agency, the work authorization component is both a regulatory problem and a statutory problem. From a regulatory standpoint, under the current regulations today under DACA, an applicant's not supposed to get work authorization unless they have economic necessity, and that's driven and by regulations by the poverty guidelines. The agency today, as they stood up that program, I think very quickly, is not only applying that provision robustly, but they actually went to the other end of the spectrum and require every single individual who's seeking benefits under DACA to get a work authorization provision. So they've gone sort of right against the regulation. And so I think that's, you know, now on a regulatory front, everyone recognizes regulations can be changed very quickly, but there's still a statutory question, and that's whether the secretary has authority to grant work authorization to potentially millions of people who would not otherwise have it under the statutory scheme. The challenge there is that Congress has been very explicit throughout the INA. There's places where you're authorized to work explicitly, and there's other places where the statute gives the secretary permission to issue work authorization. For example, someone who comes in under TPS, authorized for work authorization, but an applicant for asylum, that's discretionary of the Secretary of Homeland Security. So that is an untested issue on whether the secretary can issue employment authorization. But you've seen the agency up to this point collapse the two together, eligibility for the deferred action and work authorization into one process. And so I think there's some legal risks there that the agency needs to evaluate. It's a place where there's likely to be standing to challenge the practice. Back in the 1980s, when the INS was issuing work authorization or allowing business visitor travelers to work, unions were successful in suing the INS and getting an injunction to stop them from allowing them to work. So there is precedent to have standing to challenge the grant of work authorization by the executive branch outside of that statutory scheme. And so the agency, how it's implemented it to date, may not necessarily be the structure that they want to use going forward, and they might want to have a little bit more space between the deferred action, which is clearly prosecutorial discretion, but the separate issue of granting work authorization. I would say in closing, as the agency wrestles with all of these proposals, I've talked about two what I would consider very large programmatic changes. Wendy talked about discrete targeted provisions that the agency could do. Ultimately, we can talk all day about strategy, but really it's going to come down to timing. What are the timing considerations that the agencies are working under to implement any of these programs? Lawyers always want more time and can make it more defensible, but sometimes the public and political issues are driving the implementation timelines, in which case it will be more aggressive, but then riskier for the programs to implement.
Thank you very much. In the absence of comprehensive immigration reform, states and localities have taken matters into their own hands. Over the last several years, there have been thousands of state and local implemented and proposed ordinances and laws. So we have Mary Elena Hincapié, who is going to talk to us about what we can expect to see on a state and local level. Mary Elena is the executive director of the National Immigration Law Center, which is dedicated to defending and advancing the rights of low-income immigrants in the United States. So, Mary Elena, what do you think we're going to see?
Great. Well, thank you, Jean, and thanks again to MPI and Clinic and to CMS for this wonderful conference and to all of you for joining us today. As an immigrant from Colombia and the daughter of a guest worker, my father was recruited to the state of Rhode Island to work in the textile factory. It's really an honor for me to be leading the National Immigration Law Center, which is focused exclusively on helping and restoring the rights and opportunities of families just like mine. And the issues that our country is facing at this moment, I think we at the National Immigration Law Center believe that this isn't just about congressional action, right? And I think Wendy talked about that as well, that reform of our immigration laws and policies need to happen at all levels, at the state and local level, at the federal level. They need to happen in Congress, but they need to happen in the courts as well as in the state legislatures and in the streets, as we've seen an incredible amount of energy and momentum and political power that's being built by immigrants themselves, obviously led by dreamers like Lorela as well. So I think before I go to share a little bit about our perspective on the state and local piece, just to add on to both what Wendy and Lyndon shared, we do believe that there are some minor fixes that would make a significant difference today, that while we continue to fight for legislative immigration reform, there are things that the administration can be doing right now. And in fact, with the leadership changes at the Department of Homeland Security and with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement agencies, there's actually an opportunity for these new leaders, these new managers, to implement what's in place and to do it right. And so I think along the lines of what both Wendy and Lyndon have shared so far, there's some basic things having to do with training, accountability, transparency, record keeping, data that is necessary to understand how is prosecutorial discretion working and how is it not. Unfortunately, most of the data that we have is very minimal. And what we've seen is that very few cases are actually where prosecutorial discretion is actually being exercised. And then where it is being exercised, what people are getting, the benefit that people are getting is admin closure for the most part. So we believe that the administration can actually be looking at those cases, and when they look at their priorities, that they're actually sticking to those priorities, right? That somebody that is considered a low-level priority should be, the agent's discretion should be exercised, and that deferred action could be one of the remedies rather than simply administratively closing the case. And the reason we think that is, in the South in particular, and in other parts of the country where we're litigating, when you simply administratively close a case, that is inefficient. It is poor use of taxpayer money, because 3 weeks later, that same individual may be picked up by ICE agents again and then go through the entire system again. So instead, when the agents know that someone, you know, have assessed the case and identify that this is an individual that meets low-level priority and that meets the administration's goals of who should be here and who shouldn't be here, particularly when the administration has identified that comprehensive immigration reform is one of its legislative priorities, we shouldn't be deporting today the aspiring citizens of tomorrow, right? We should be doing everything possible to ensure that people who would qualify for Senate Bill 744 and who are prima facie eligible for the registered provisional immigrant status, the RPI status in the Senate bill, they should benefit from prosecutorial discretion and allow us to continue doing the work that needs to be done for Congress to eventually enact immigration reform. So I think issues with respect to prosecutorial discretion are really critical, because that's about enforcing the existing policies in a better way. Second is detainer reform. One of the places where we've seen quite a bit of energy around the country at the local level is efforts to try to change, whether it's through litigation, whether it's through local ordinances or state policy, how the collaboration between local law enforcement agents and immigration agents is resulting in, again, people who should be considered low-level priority and who should be considered a high-level priority for immigration reform, who should and are eligible or would qualify for immigration reform, that they should not be detained. And what's happening right now is there's so much confusion and misinformation at the law enforcement level about what does an ICE hold request mean, and is there a requirement that somebody be held or not. We have a lawsuit in, or had a lawsuit because we reached a settlement, that the National Immigration Law Center co co-counseled with the New Orleans Worker Center for Racial Justice, where individual day laborers were being detained by the Orleans Parish Sheriff and held for 180 plus days, right? Simply after criminal charges were dropped and the initial interaction with local police, unfortunately, was racial profiling, and the criminal charges are dropped, but the individuals still were held on an ice hold for months and months and months. Fortunately, we reached a settlement with the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Department, and it actually is an incredibly progressive detainer policy. They have had a complete change, and that detainer policy in New Orleans should be adopted by ICE and by DHS and should be the policy that is used throughout the country. And there are other policies that have been worked on throughout. So I think that the last piece on the federal level that I would add is, and this came up in the earlier discussions in the earlier panels today, as we look at the demographic shift and we look at the formidable machinery of immigration enforcement, as MPI has reported on, we need to be concerned about the way that immigration enforcement is actually resulting in so much racial profiling, or at least the perception from the community that there is racial profiling, and the impact that it's having to undermine policing, community policing in particular. And so as a country, we need to ensure that we're focusing on the rule of law and on due process rights, and ensuring that, as I think Morrison mentioned in the earlier panel, that we're focusing on prevention rather than enforcement. And again, particularly when we're looking at an 11 million undocumented population, many of whom should be and would be eligible for immigration reform. And the final point in terms of changes is there should be restrictions or, frankly, bans on the use of ICE agents. And again, this is happening particularly in the South, so it's not a surprise, where ICE agents are mining state criminal justice databases or driver's license databases to use that as one of the sources that it's going after people who are undocumented. And focusing on problem agencies like New Orleans and Miami, where we've seen time and time again repeated violations of constitutional rights, new leadership at DHS really needs to hone in on those offices and hold them accountable. So I will switch over to the state level advocacy, because again, there's a pattern here. It's not a surprise that we at the National Immigration Law Center with our civil rights partners have been litigating these state law, anti-immigrant laws that passed over the last couple of years. It's not a surprise they're in the South, right? We in 2010 sued Arizona. In 2011, we sued Utah, Indiana, Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina. Well, fortunately, I can report this week we reached a settlement with Alabama. You may have read the New York Times editorial today that Alabama's shameful history on immigration reform has ended, and that the settlement that we reached is a result of a lot of different things. One is definitely the cost of litigation. Second, it's the economic impact that these laws have had in those states where it's been documented that rather than actually resulting in undocumented immigrants necessarily being detained and deported or self-deporting, as that was one of the original intentions of the attrition through enforcement policy, but in fact, what people are doing is people are going deeper into the underground economy. The level of fear, Alabama in particular, part of the settlement is that on equal protection grounds, the state will no longer, although this was just temporarily blocked by the courts, they will not seek information about students' immigration status or their parents' immigration status. So the fact that in Alabama and in other states, we have students who are not able to learn because they are so afraid of whether they're going to see their mother at the end of the day. And similarly, that a mother, when she gets into her car in the morning and is driving down the street to take her child to school or to a medical appointment, is petrified of whether she will see that child at the end of the day or not. That is simply un-American. And what's happened over the last year is a complete shift in the tide. What we're seeing, as opposed to what we saw in the last couple of years of these anti-immigrant laws, we've seen major changes. The majority of the anti-immigrant laws at the state level, the bills that were being introduced, have failed this year. And in fact, 2013, frankly, in California, for example, we are calling it the year of the immigrant. And I'd like to say that actually, you know, with immigration reform happening at both state and federal level, it should be the year of the immigrant at the level of at the national level as well. The three areas that I'd like to focus on where we've seen a major shift have been on tuition equity, driver's license and workers' rights, and then again on issues relating to immigration enforcement. So in terms of driver's licenses, over the last decade, unfortunately, because of 9/11, the rhetoric around access to driver's licenses was frankly hijacked by FAIR, looking at this and making this issue of undocumented immigrants gaining access to driver's licenses as a terrorist issue. And finally, common sense has prevailed. This year alone, we now have another 8 states in 2013 that have enacted laws that allow for immigrants to have access to driver's licenses or driving privileges that will allow them to be part of everyday activities without that fear that if they get in the car, they will be detained and put into deportation proceedings and that families will be ripped apart simply because of that. And we will also have drivers who are trained, who are insured, and who, again, are contributing to the economy in those states. So with driver's licenses in particular, we saw, in addition to New Mexico, Utah, and Washington that already had such laws on the books, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Maryland, Oregon, Nevada, and Vermont added to that. And I know Washington, D.C. has been, and New Mexico and North Carolina had been looking at bills. The repeal attempts from an anti-immigrant perspective in North Carolina and in New Mexico failed. The one outlier is Arizona. So Arizona with Governor Brewer, what she did was instead of whether it was repealing driver's licenses or not, as soon as DACA was announced by the president, that same day she issued an executive order basically denying driver's licenses to individuals who received DACA. That despite the fact that the statute in Arizona says that anyone who is lawfully present and work authorized as someone with DACA would be eligible. So we sued on behalf of the Arizona Dream Act Coalition, ADEC. We sued the state of Arizona and have been mired in litigation. And recently, Arizona took a step further and announced they were going to make some policy changes. And rather than having common sense and repealing this misguided policy denying driver's licenses to DACA recipients, instead they have now decided they're going to deny driver's licenses to anyone who has deferred action and work authorization. So that lawsuit continues. So on driver's licenses, we've seen an incredible amount of energy and success in 2013. There will definitely be more of that in 2014 for sure. We've seen already just in the last couple of weeks, we at the National Immigration Law Center have been contacted by advocates in other states who are getting their model legislation ready for the new legislative sessions starting in January. The other place where we saw an incredible amount of success was tuition equity. So these are state bills that would allow for individuals who have gone to that state's high school, can prove residency, and irrespective of their immigration status, that they would be able to go to higher education paying the in-state tuition rate. This benefits both undocumented students, but it also benefits other students who may have moved more recently, U.S. citizen students that moved from another state to ex-state. Again, this is a place where we've seen an incredible amount of success. Today, 60% of the foreign-born population live in a state with tuition equity laws. That is huge. That is immigration reform at the state level. That is about opening opportunities of educational and economic growth for the individuals, for the families, and the communities in those states. And in 2013 in particular, the reason I think we had so much success is that we as legal advocates worked closely with Dreamers on the ground who, now that they had DACA, they were much more ready to take on the new battle and engage in some of the state legislative advocacy as well. So again, tuition equity has been the other place of success. Workers' rights is the third category that I'd want to highlight and particularly really lift up the work that the National Domestic Workers Alliance has been doing. The New York Domestic Workers Bill of Rights passed in New York a couple of years ago, and this year the states of California and Hawaii also enacted similar laws. And these are important because, again, this is about making a difference. While we get immigration reform, this is about making a difference in real people's lives every single day. How quality of life for a low-wage worker, especially a domestic worker, can actually improve. And then there's the regulatory work that was done through the Department of Labor that actually finally, after decades and decades of exclusion, domestic workers now are on par with other low-wage workers with respect to their rights under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And again, an incredibly historic administrative regulatory change that was done through a lot of advocacy and organizing by domestic workers and their allies. And then in California this year, we also had three bills that focus on anti-retaliation protection. So these are three different bills that now have been signed into law by the governor, which look at undocumented workers who are a major part of the workforce in California and a major part of our economy, and basically provide additional protections against retaliation by employers who will use either the fact that somebody is undocumented and is trying to organize or improve their working conditions and report them to any government agency, including immigration, or at least threatening would be considered retaliation under these state bills, but also including the misuse of E-Verify in the employment context, again, for retaliation against the workers. So those are very important workers' rights protections that have gone into law. And similar, we're going to see a lot of other state organizers and advocates try to build on this in 2014. And then finally, because I think this brings us full circle, is state laws that have really worked on, and actually this is state and local, that have really tried to restore the trust in the police and really bring much more public safety to our communities. And this is the Trust Act, which passed both in Connecticut and in California. Really significant because this is about limiting, again, the collaboration and when law enforcement needs to hold someone for immigration when there's a minor offense, either traffic or misdemeanors. And each of the state laws are a little bit different. But again, this is because the detention and deportation system have run amok, and the lack of accountability within federal immigration enforcement agencies is so huge. State and local efforts are needed basically to try to provide some protections. We could work at this from both directions, the local and state level, but obviously at the administrative level, if the Department of Homeland Security and the Obama administration prioritize these changes, we'll see much more systemic change and allow for a society where immigrants are contributing, where people can be provided their full potential to our democracy and not live in fear, and can, as aspiring citizens, be part of the fabric of our society as we continue working on legislative immigration reform as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Elena. Mary Elena, you mentioned that the majority of anti-immigrant bills have failed this year, and you highlighted several that have been enacted, and I'm wondering to what you attribute this.
So I think it's a combination of, again, the economic impact, right? The fiscal impact of the anti-immigrant laws, it was a myth. I think a lot of the folks, like Chris Kobach, who helped author these, one, people thought that people would self-deport, not happening. If they're self-deporting, they're simply going to another state, to the neighboring state. Second is really the demographic shifts and the political power from the organizing that developed as a result of these laws. So Arizona, again, I think is an outlier, but again, the level of organizing and advocacy that has happened in Arizona as well in some of these other states have allowed for the community to put much more pressure. There was a recall of Russell Pierce, for example, as a result of all of this. So we're seeing much more activism and a much more diverse coalition of the business community also coming out against these anti-immigrant laws, the economic impact. And then at the federal level, because there has now been over the last year and because of the presidential results in 2012, much more hope that immigration reform would be happening at the federal level. I think states have held back from trying to enact some of these anti-immigrant laws and taken immigration into their own hands.
Great. Wendy and Lyndon, is it safe to say, and actually Mary Elena as well, that this panel is saying that without comprehensive immigration reform, there will be administrative action, or have what you've expressed, things that you think could happen? So I'm asking you to kind of pretend you have a crystal ball a little bit.
You want to jump in first?
I think there's a window of opportunity here, you know, while we figure out comprehensive immigration reform, and that we shouldn't hold administrative action hostage to the legislation and allow it to suck the air out of the room. And I think particularly for this administration, the clock is now ticking, and a lot of what we talked about today takes time. It takes time for agencies to work out these policies. Mm-hmm. So let's get going now.
I think this is the most difficult strategic decision for the administration. I think people underestimate how much pressure it takes to pass any major legislation of any type, not just immigration, and how rare it is. And so I think that the strategic question as you evaluate any of the proposals, whether there's technically small proposals or significant issues, is how will that affect the likelihood of immigration reform passing? And in particular, when you talk to Republicans who have reservations about it, there's definitely a trust issue and a confidence level in what would happen after it passes. And so I think it's not easy to put them all into one category. I think it's more important to look at each of the various proposals and say, is this something that can be done now? And if so, how would it affect, how will it be received by supporters and opponents? Because I think there is still recognition. None of the ideas we're talking about here address the core structural issues that immigration legislation needs to address. These are all Band-Aids and not structural fixes.
Right. And I would just add, because of Lyndon's comment, like, we at the National Immigration Law Center are committed to making sure that we win immigration reform. We do believe that it's a matter of when, not if. And so while the legislative advocacy is continuing, there are a lot of the things that we talked about are administrative changes that can happen now that really aren't even tied to a broader immigration relief, but technical fixes that would make a difference, that would ensure that existing policies are actually being implemented in the most generous way, and frankly, even being implemented, because some are not even being implemented. The last thing I would say is I failed to mention this earlier, but on the administrative side, I think the other place where we believe there needs to be a lot of effort, and again, this is both from the administration, but also from advocates, is DACA implementation, right? We need to make sure that right now, this form of relief is available to young immigrants, but there are major challenges, right, particularly in rural communities, in the API community, which are two areas that we at NILC are looking at very carefully, but also that the administration is learning, right, that we're fixing the glitches along the way, because from the administrative implementation piece of it, but also from the lack of the challenges that we have in terms of legal infrastructure. And these are the things that we need to make sure that DACA is successfully implemented so that we're fully ready to implement immigration reform when we actually enact that.
All right, thank you. We'd love to take questions from the floor.
A couple of questions to maybe broaden the discussion, and thanks for a great panel, all four of you. Lyndon, I'm wondering if in looking for standards to apply, if you're going to try to make up standards to put some substance into extreme hardship under the waivers programs, you probably have already thought about this, but getting beyond the immigration box and looking at what the standards are that have been developed either by other humanitarian agencies that care about family unity, whether it's refugee families, whether it's international or domestic, or also looking generally at child welfare system standards. Because if we stay in the immigration box, we know that the predominant ideology is deportation and enforcement. So maybe borrowing some other ways of looking at why keeping families together is so important from other areas of law or policy might be a place to go. And then for Wendy, a really quick comment. A very smart community organizer in Chicago a couple weeks ago told a story about a village that finds a baby floating down the river, and they rescue the baby. And then the next day there's two babies floating down the river, and they rescue those babies. And then the next day there are five. And they finally decide to send somebody upriver to see who's throwing babies in the river. So I'm wondering if KIND and related groups could use as your platform in Guatemala to try to figure out and tell us, why has there been such a huge increase in children coming in from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador? I think an understanding of what the root causes are needs to be part of our advocacy, whether they're causes that we can actually do anything about or not, but I think it'll inform how we frame policies.
Let me tackle the first question. I think it's an excellent question and something that the immigration agencies have always wrestled with. The agencies are often tasked with making humanitarian, economic, commerce decisions. And it's not that they are not well-meaning, but sometimes you don't always have the same breadth of experience or same expertise. And so I think I would just add on top of what you said, I mean, you could certainly look at other standards and borrow from other standards. I would add you could also bring in other agencies with expertise like you do in the refugee and asylum setting, where there's either referrals or they get to bring in some standards or set some guidelines and borrow from them entirely. Or you can do what I've seen CIS do more recently in the business setting is just try and build up your own internal expertise and do some hiring, just like an outside business sector would do if you're going to be making those determinations. So I think those are all excellent improvements, and I think they've all been considered before. At the end of the day, though, to be realistic, it's still an act of discretion with general standards. And anytime you have that, you're going to have people reaching different conclusions looking at the same facts. And the agency is still going to have to decide how much do they want to rein that in. And if they rein it in, that makes it more difficult to implement versus having looser standards, but then some people aren't going to get through the door. But I'm a big fan of figuring out the best way to get the best answer in terms of expertise. I would just add that I don't know if it's just borrowing standards, and you might want to look at those other options.
And just to add to that before I get to Susan's other question is another standard that I think should be looked at in the immigration system is the best interest of the child standard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you look at family unity issues, as you look at how unaccompanied children are treated, to really make child-centered, child-focused decisions that are in the best interest. I'm glad you raised the issue of why are kids coming. And there are a number of us looking at that. Kind released a report called The Time Is Now, looking at basically analyzing our caseload. We've served over 6,000 children to look at patterns in the caseload to see what children themselves are citing as their reasons for coming. The MacArthur Foundation has supported a number of organizations to look more concretely at root causes of migration, particularly from Central America and Mexico. And a number of reports will be coming out over the course of the next couple of months addressing that issue. And I think it's important. This morning, I think you heard a lot about the pull factors for migration, but I think it's equally important to look at the push factors and really start to think more holistically about how do we address these issues. On the issue of child migration, some of the things that we're hearing consistently, and I will say no one story or one child's experience is the same as another, but some of the things that we hear pretty consistently is that kids are fleeing gang violence and narco-trafficking-generated violence in Central America. It's no longer safe for them to remain home. And we're seeing that gangs in particular are recruiting kids at younger and younger ages, so the average age of the kids arriving in the United States is starting to drop. A much greater percentage of kids under age 12. We're also seeing more girls arrive as opposed to the old days. And looking at those root causes, addressing those root causes is so, so important, because for a child to be moving on their own is an incredibly dangerous thing. What we're also seeing is increased rates of sexual violence against girls, for example, as they move across Mexico. So I sometimes am disappointed that when we talk about immigration, we tend to think it's just this, it's an issue inside the borders of the United States. This really is a cross-border international issue.
Hello. My name is Dan Vock. I'm a reporter with Stateline. I write a lot about the state policies that you were talking about. My question is, one thing that I hear often is, you know, for a while you had a lot of anti-immigrant laws passed, and the Supreme Court ruled in such states you've overstepped too far. Mm-hmm. Are you worried about, especially things like the Trust Act in California, that the federal, you know, whether it's the federal government generally or the Supreme Court specifically, is going to say, you know what, this is the province of the federal government, California, you've gone too far to tell local agencies what they can do with ICE holds?
I think it's a great question. I think the way that the state laws now, both in California and Connecticut, have been drafted. So anytime you're drafting legislation, right, you're always thinking about what are the potential legal implications and any potential backlash or challenges. But because the police powers that a state has include things like workers' rights and what the role of law enforcement is, and particularly local police, which that's what the Connecticut and California bills are doing, is really it's about limiting what local law enforcement agents in that state can do. So we believe that it you know, it's unlikely that it would be challenged. Maybe a lawsuit would be filed, but I think they were drafted in a way to really look at and address those potential legal arguments against it.
Hi, good morning. My name is Barrington Sam, and I'm a reporter at the Washington Informer. I'm wondering if, particularly probably Marilena, if you could comment on what you think is fueling what's going on in Arizona and the choices that Jan Brewer is making.
Sure, and I'm sure others have thoughts on that as well. you know, I think, and this came up, I think, in the earlier panel as well about when there is one political party that is controlling. So in Arizona in particular, we've had, you know, there is a super majority of Republicans. And frankly, I think it's short-sightedness, right? It is this sense of policymakers who are stuck in trying to control their policymaking for a small minority of people, despite the demographics in their state, really showing a very, very, very different trajectory. And I think, in terms of who is coming out, who has come out to vote for those policymakers, including who has elected Governor Brewer, is a very different, set of Arizonans than those laws are affecting. So I think given how much Governor Brewer and the Arizona State Legislature has overstepped, and they're doing this in all realms, right? Not just anti-immigrant. It's anti-Latino. It's anti-worker, anti-women. There are a number of different policies that they've made. It has brought the community much more to, you know, much closer together. So you've got African Americans, women's groups, workers' rights groups, unions, immigrants' rights working together now to really come bring about a political change, which is finally, I think, at the end of the day, what's going to make a difference in Arizona.
Cora Newman from CARE.com. I just wanted to know, I know that there are different state-level initiatives and different bills that are passing across the country, and I'm wondering, obviously, hopefully these are preparatory, potentially preparatory for national immigration reform, but to what degree are states looking at preparing systems so that they are able to react to broad-sweeping reform, or will we have to reinvent the wheel if and when it passes?
Yes, I can start, but, you know, you guys, for sure, it's actually one of the biggest challenges that we have. Both with respect to DACA implementation, we've already seen, right, and immigration reform, it will be much larger given the scale that we're looking at. I think one of the things that maybe policymakers and public servants may not be fully aware, and in a state like California, we are very aware of when any of these changes go into effect, whether it's DACA, which is administrative, or whether it's immigration reform legislatively or even administratively, as we've discussed, it really impacts every part of society. Everyone will be touched by that. And so I would share with DACA, in the school districts, for example, in California, there was an immediate challenge in terms of the ability for school districts to provide copies of transcripts, official transcripts, to individuals who needed them as in their application. And that's just, and it really bogged up the entire system. And so there are a lot of things like that at the state and local level, that because of DACA, states have started realizing they need to really figure out those quirks. I see, Maria Angeles here from the Mexican embassy. The embassies also have realized what they need to do, to help be prepared for not just DACA, but immigration reform. So I think all of these things, which is why we believe that making sure that DACA is implemented as successfully as possible, so that when we are ready to implement immigration reform, we could really build on that. I think someone asked in the earlier panel as well is about the integration provisions and the integration title within the Senate bill. There's nothing like that in the House right now, but those integration measures and making sure that there are enough funds for state and local government agencies to implement immigration reform and reap the benefits from immigration reform will be very critical.
I'd say one thing that I've seen differently in the past few years that I do consider to, I wouldn't say problematic, but could be improved. In 06 and 07, the Department of Homeland Security, which has had a lot of experience implementing large immigration programs, it's not always perfect. There's a graveyard of litigation out there. But they have done it before, and they were very much at the table, and the experts within the agency were at the table and helping guide Congress on how changes in eligibility standards, timeframes, et cetera, would impact how the program would be run. And I haven't seen that same level of coordination in the past year or two, and I think it's for a variety of reasons. I would say it only half jokingly. I'd hope this panel would be about implementation issues, mm-hmm. because I don't think they can be underestimated. And I think subtle changes in the law can have dramatic effect in the success of a program. And when you're operating in a very sensitive political environment, making sure that you get that language right up front can be critical to the success on the back end. And so if there's one wish I had, we would see a little bit more of the career expertise channeling up to the Hill as part of those legislative discussions.
Good morning. My name is Tania Lizari. I'm from the Office of Refugee Resettlement. But actually, my question is not related to our UAC program. It's actually related to if you know of any procedural or administrative reform for the people that are petitioned by family members. The system right now is kind of like they have a priority system, and it may take 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20, depending from the country that they are. And these are people that want to bring their family members in a legal way, but they're also like in a limbo because they're not really usually part of the discussion because they're trying to do it within the system. So I was just wondering if you guys knew of any reform or anything like that to that system to make it seem a little bit more productive for those people as well.
Well, I mean, I think you touched upon one of the core structural problems in the immigration law today, and that's the green card numbers and the wait times. And that's not unique to family members. We have clients with very professional, highly educated employees who face 10-year, by some calculations, 20 to 50-year waits for green cards as well. Now, most of them are here in the United States waiting for that time frame, but they're also in limbo. And so I think you are correct that is an issue when we talk about any administrative reform. The green card restructuring and addressing those challenges is very limited for the agencies to do anything. So there are proposals. You could certainly parole people in. You could identify folks and parole them in the United States. The administrative relief that we've talked about doesn't need to be limited to folks who are already in the United States. You could look at those as a concept. But I think that, as you mentioned, the constituency group is not as strong for folks outside the United States. And I think that if you saw any relief, it would be focused on folks who are already here.
Lyndon, could you see a deferred action for people who are here and already in the priority wait?
Well, I think that's building upon like the waiver program for folks who are here and who are now. I guess what that question of folks who could immigrate today under legal channels, but either by the way they entered the United States or their conduct after the fact prevents them from immigrating through those channels. So there's two separate issues. Is one, removing the legal roadblocks that allows them to get back onto the path. And the other one is whether there's sufficient numbers in place. So we already talked about the numbers, that's really going to be a congressional issue. That's not something that the agency can do. But in terms of removing some of those roadblocks and allowing people to get on a legal channel, I would say, yes, there's certainly some places where you could work around the edges. And if there's one bit of good news when you look at the political debate on the Hill, increasingly you hear Republicans, as they don't necessarily introduce their bill, but they talk about the concept of their bill, is that they would allow folks to immigrate in the same way as everyone else through those legal channels. And when I hear that, that means I hear support for, or at least maybe not as much backlash for, allowing individuals who can qualify through unemployment and family-based channels. The agency, I think, will have greater leeway on the political arena to allow people to do that. And I think you've seen that with the provisional waiver program. It's been less controversial, even though you are, in essence, waiving the 3 and 10 year bar, which just 10 years ago was really the hallmark of an enforcement structure, and it's been less controversial. So there's some optimism there on that front.
Hi, thank you so much for your presentations. I'm Bernadette Passad-Cisse, formerly of a number of organizations advocating on behalf of immigrants. I just wanted to follow up on one of Wendy's recommendations regarding alternative to detention. My question is, has it been your experience that entities like the Corrections Corporation of America have had, their lobbying efforts have had a great impact on U.S. detention policy? And do you see their lobbying efforts continuing to have an impact on U.S. detention policy?
I mean, I think that's a good question. And there's a lot of financial interest now in sustaining a large detention program, including by the company that you just cited. And is definitely a factor. It's also true that state and localities have benefited from the detention program as well through the prison system. So that's once that's kind of instilled and becomes part of the system, it's very hard, I think, to fight back. So definitely a factor.
Yeah, no, definitely agree. I think that this issue is one of those, and this is more of a legislative issue in terms of appropriations. I think there are potential opportunities for fiscal conservatives, for Tea Party Republicans to not continue throwing more and more money at whether it's detention beds, the 34,000 mandate, the administration really reassessing the number of people that it's detaining, right? There is no statutory requirement that 400,000 people be detained and deported. And we are dangerously close to the 2 million mark of the number of people who will be, have been deported under this administration. There are so many economically common sense alternatives, as well as from a moral and values perspective in terms of what, how this administration is dealing with detention and deportation issues.
Among the activities, Wendy and Mary Lane, you mentioned it could be taking place now, is training. Could you expand a little more on what kind of training you're talking about and for what groups?
Sure. I'll speak as one example to the training of immigration judges. One of the side effects of problems with the budget has been that the immigration judge annual training session has been canceled for, I think, at least 3 years now. You know, they're seeking cheaper forms of training that, you know, are technology-based, but I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said for bringing them together, learning together, hearing from outside trainers. So, you know, and particularly with unaccompanied children, I will say that we've seen efforts to try and make the courtroom more child-friendly, but sometimes it's, how can I say it, it's fairly simplistic. It's, you know, the judge having a bowl of candy for the children, the judge asking, so how, you know, can I see your report card? And, you know, I don't mean to dismiss those efforts, and we appreciate that, but I think that more systematic training from a child welfare perspective would go a long way so that the judges are really enabled to ask and interview children in a way that they can get to the information they need to make an objective and fair adjudication.
Yeah, so I think that the training is really, frankly, needed at all levels, and I'm curious to see if Lyndon, if you've got particular thoughts on this, because I think Lyndon shared something that was really important, is in terms of the ability to bring in experts, both whether it's from a hiring perspective or other experts that can help in terms of the training on standards, right? When you look at the extreme hardship standard, you know, what is the way that experts would define that? From a child-centric perspective, from a family unity perspective, you know, what is, in terms of detainers or in terms of prosecutorial discretion, what does reasonable cause or probable cause, what are those standards really like, and how is there uniformity? Can the administration or the agency provide training so there is uniformity? Because what we've seen is there's a lack of uniformity, and because it is just, these are all discretionary measures, you may have one person who is a street vendor in L.A. that's detained and ends up being put into the detention and deportation system, whereas a street vendor in New York may not. And, you know, just using that as an example. But again, really, I think these are all very complex areas of law, and the intersection with other areas of law really require much more rigorous training. And then that allows for all agents to have the same level of information and for there to be accountability, which is a really equally important piece of the puzzle, I think.
And consistency.
Yeah. But Lyndon, did you have particular thoughts on this?
Yeah, and maybe I'm wearing my government hat a little too much here, but I wouldn't say just because there's inconsistency that necessarily mean there's a training issue. And I think there's sometimes a desire to say if there's two different outcomes under one set of guidance, it means someone needs to be trained on that. It could be because that guidance, as we've been talking about, allowed for discretion.
Right.
And by definition, if you have discretion, reasonable people are going to reach different conclusions. Right. And so I think I agree with it. I think, you know, training is important, but I think as a preliminary matter, you first have to decide as an organization, are we comfortable with the guidance that's going out and what the parameters are for the people who are applying that guidance? You can't go beat up on people who you've given the opportunity to reach different conclusions and say, but I didn't really want you to reach different conclusions. You first have to decide as an organization, what are the boundaries, and then make sure people are staying within those boundaries. Now, as I said, how much leeway do you want to allow adjudicators and how much leeway do you want the agency to have in applying things? A lot of that goes back to those early structural questions, which is the program going to be stood up in a very structured way and a very definitive way? But then you're going to have a lot of rulemaking and a slow process to stand up to get all of that out there. If you move quickly, you need to appreciate adjudicators going to operate in a wider leeway. And I think that's what you're seeing in some of the programs in the past few years.
I think we have time for one more question.
There's been a bit for a while. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Omar, and I'm from Chicago. I have an online radio show called The Voice of African Youth. Now, I have a question for all of you guys. I'm more interested about African immigrants. Some of the issues that African immigrants have when they come to the States, when they start going to school, as international students, first they have financial issues, and then after they get out of status. And there are not too many informations about immigrations, about Africa, regarding African immigrants. What do you guys are doing to inform people? Is it because Africans are not involved, or what Africans should do to have more information about immigration issues? Thank you.
Sure. I mean, I think that in terms of what we do, so we at the National Immigration Law Center, we do a lot of trainings. We also do have a lot of publications and try to disseminate it through a lot of different listservs and networks that we work with. I think for the African immigrant community in particular, I would say the last couple of years, we've seen a growth in much more infrastructure. There is, again, both within immigration reform, but unfortunately, we've seen, for example, immigration enforcement programs, detention and deportation, and the rise of racial profiling at the state and local level particularly impact African communities, so that there is much more cross-collaboration across ethnic groups, including African immigrants. And so I'm happy to talk to you afterwards about some of the organizations that we're aware of that we're starting to do much more work with, that are both working on legislative advocacy for immigration reform, but more importantly, what are the services and advocacy or organizing that are needed at the local level where African immigrants, where there's a larger number of African immigrants. So that would be an initial thought. I don't know if you, either of you.
I'm just going to throw a bone to Lyndon here and talk for a second about implementation. In looking at implementation for comprehensive immigration reform for when it happens, we've been looking at lessons learned in DACA as well as the old Immigration Reform and Control Act. And in both of those, it looked like there was underrepresentation of the African community as well as Asian communities. And so that has been a real focus, I can tell you, nationally, in looking at models that would be helpful to reaching out to all communities and building capacity in some of those communities now. So there is a lot happening. It just may not all be kind of out in the open and on a nationally visible level. Mm-hmm. So it's time. Thank you all so much. Thank you, Lyndon, Wendy, and Mary Elena.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.